Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPW 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course, I'm Al Warren, and co-host today, and almost every day, we've got Mr. David North Martino.
I'm here with my full three names.
3 days. You see, we're doing the
three
whole
days.
Week.
Three days.
The whole week is treat Dave nice. It's the treat
Dave. Yeah,
but
next week, it's going to be terrible.
Yeah, it'll be double.
Be all built up.
Yeah, it's going to be worse. It's going to be, you know, of being nice all week, I'm going to have to be really, really nasty.
Yes. So,
you know.
I look forward to it.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think that people know that you kind of enjoy that sort of thing.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. They think that, you know, you're crying in the back and going and drinking
Tearing
and being
up.
Upset and going to the bar and. And all that stuff. And it's
telling my troubles to the bartender.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just not true.
No.
Yeah. So now we are going across the world today. We quite often do, but it's a stop that we haven't made before. We're going to be talking with an author out of India. And now the book she's promoting is The Mangalore Detectives Club. Now, this is the first of a detective series that she's writing. And so, Harini Najendra, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. This is such a pleasure.
Well, hopefully you feel that way at the end of the show. You know, I mean,
I hope it's
always a pleasure to start, you know. But now, you heard of us because you listened to our show or something?
Yes, I do. So I came across a couple of episodes of the show, and I thought this was fabulous. Especially, I guess what I really liked is the questions you had about the writing process and about creativity and all of the. It was fun, so that's why I reached out to you.
Oh, good. See, so now you kind of know what to expect. We never know. Sometimes people get surprised.
We'll have to change it up.
Yeah. Now, so how did you get into this writing world, as we'd say, like, and especially with fiction? Like, what brought you to write this book?
A fiction book is sort of like returning home after a long journey. So I mean, I'm a career academic, I'm an ecologist, I write research papers all the time. I've written nonfiction books. But when I was very young, I used to write fiction. So stories, short stories, little books for my dad when he traveled, you know, little things like that. Little short stories for newspapers, kids stuff mostly. And then I didn't. I moved into a PhD and then got into a different world of writing academic stuff. And then nonfiction that's that's for the public. So that's a little more accessible than academic papers. But I did always want it. My first love was fiction writing. And then I started doing a lot of work on Bangalore, which is the city I live in and which is the city I love more than anything else. And because of the work I was doing on the history of the ecology of the city, I had all this data, I mean, archival material, old photographs, old stories. And I was going through this sort of ruthlessly tossing out anything that didn't belong to ecology. But I keep going down rabbit holes of fascinating things that had nothing to do with work, but were just very interesting about the city. And my main character, who is a 19-year-old woman in 1921 Bangalore, Kaveri, just popped into my head in 2007 one day and sort of demanded that I write a book about her. Her name was different. Her name was then Bhagirathi. And for some reason, I don't even know how this works. As I started writing, her name changed to Kaveri, which is what it is now. But the essential character of the woman was very much similar, very young, very independent, very feisty, butting against the conventions of society. And so I started thinking of what book I would write. Now that's 2007. We're now in 2022. So it's taken me a while to get here. But this is how the journey started.
Well, so basically you were sloughing off on your job, not doing it, and going through different things that were interesting. And then you started hearing voices in 2007 telling you. So did you blow up any buildings or drive off any roads or anything as well? Did the voice tell you to do other things? No, I think it's funny to me. A lot of fiction writers will say that. So do you find it a problem writing in the place of a young woman in 1921? Because, you know, obviously that's not you. You're not that old. So how do you find capturing that, the essence of that kind of a person?
So it's, I love stories and I love getting old family stories. So my mom told me a whole bunch of stories, like my grandmom, her grandmom, my aunts and their stories, my husband's aunt who actually went swimming in a sari. So the book opens with the heroine Kaveri going swimming in a sari. And that's inspired by my husband's aunt who went swimming in a sari in the 1930s. And so there are a lot of these women that I spoke to and talked to about those times. And I'm just channeling them, I guess. My grandmom, my father's mother was born in 1907. So it spanned generations in that sense. I'm not writing about a time too different from when she grew up. And I do have stories of her time when she grew up, how she wanted to go to school and had to go on hunger strike for her father to allow her to go to school. So, yeah, I guess I'm putting a lot of those stories into this. I don't know if you can't get those from archival documents. I think you have to get them from people and knowing about how people thought.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. I mean, I think so too. Because there's something about like living in a time in a certain location, like right now, you know what it's like to live there in 2022. Mm-hmm. And there's nuance, there's things that happen in the way people act and talk and react to each other that you're not going to get out of a historical document.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's important. So it took you a long time. Did it take you this whole time to get this book together, or was it, and is that because you were just busy with work and other things, or is the process that long for you to do?
What was very difficult for me to do, it sounds funny, but I'm writing a murder mystery, right? And that's the kind of fiction I love reading. So cozy mysteries. But I'm not really, I can't read grimdark kind of stuff. I don't write that way. And so for me, even to write in a murder, as my editor recently reminded me with book two, it was so hard to get a murder into book one. I was trying to do the whole murder mystery with people getting knocked on the head, people maybe getting threatened, but nobody died. So I had to get myself into the mental frame of actually having a murder in the book and having it quite early in the book. So the plot went through a few changes. Life got in the way. I was very ambitious. So Kaveri popped into my head in 2007 when I was 2 months pregnant. And I thought that, yeah, I'll get this done. I've got a, especially when my daughter was born, I said, okay, I'm going to have 3 months off. All I'm going to be doing is looking after a baby. She's going to sleep anyway. I'll get this repeat.
Did that work?
No, it did not work. So, but what's interesting is when she's now 14 and when she was 10 or 11, that's when I really started rewriting. You know, I'd written about a third each way and changed the plot 3 times. And then my agent happens to be an old school friend, and she'd come to Bangalore. She lives in New Jersey. And we said, let's meet. And then she said, look, I would like to see this book. And I said, look, it's only going to happen if you give me a deadline. Because, again, as an academic, I write to deadlines. So I said, give me a deadline. So she gave me a deadline and I got version one to her. But my daughter, who was then by then 10, started reading the drafts and commenting on the drafts. So I think it's a good thing I waited in a way. Because with book two, I had to get book two done in 4 months. And she was one of my most important beta readers. So now she's in there. She knows, she says, you know, you had this on page one and you have this on page 25 and doesn't make sense.
Right. Yeah, that's important. Yeah, you want to make sure. So do you outline? I guess this is hard to, like, did you outline your characters ahead of time? So you kind of know who they are and what their flaws are and stuff, or you just kind of went with it?
So I cannot outline my characters because to me that doesn't work. When I sit down and write, the characters need to tell me who they are. They need to tell me what they like. And so that happens through the process of writing. And so I'd say, thinking back at my book, and now I've turned in the draft of book two in the series, it's very much character-driven more than plot-driven for me, but the characters need to reveal themselves to me. And it happens very organically. You know, they do something, and they're doing something tells me about who they are, and then they go off and do something else. So, but on the flip side, what that makes is, I mean, I rewrote book one so many times in terms of the basic plot itself, not the characters, but the plot, you know, who the murderer was, why they were doing the murder, or the entire plot. And I didn't have the time to do that again for book two. So for book two, what I did was I wrote out the book in like 10 pages. And again, I sat down, I had an opening scene. I had no idea what was going there, but I wrote it in 10 pages as opposed to a 300 page book. And then I did my revision of the plot there. And then I wrote the full book from there. But what happened in book one, two, that new characters appeared, side characters. And they took on lives of their own and they inserted themselves into the plot. So maybe that's going to happen in book three. I don't know.
Well, you know, you mentioned deadlines. And how do you think your academic career and your nonfiction writing has affected your fiction writing? Do you think it's made it more efficient?
I think there's three things if I think it's done. The first thing, which is I think very useful now that I'm actually getting reviews and feedback, is I have really thick skin because, you know, as academics, I write, 10 papers a year and they go to peer review, and sometimes for 3 years they get rejected from 7-8 journals. I've had reviewers, because it's anonymous reviews, saying things like, oh, this person is trying to squeeze paper from data like trying to squeeze blood from a stone, you know? And that's the kind of peer review you get, any academic gets. So you really become, you know what you want to do, and you know, so I'm very thankful for review because I like to improve my work. So I take the substance of it, but I don't care about the tone in which it's given. You know, so that's why I think I found really useful. Because to begin with, I think my editor, and she was very nice, she started giving me this feedback and it was very gentle. Like, you know, you'll see track changes all across this manuscript in red. And if the color frightens you, you can change it to green or something like that. And I said, you know, all of this is fine. Just tell me what you want me to do. You don't have to start with a paragraph of this is great. This, I love this about the manuscript. And then the but, just start with the but. and I'm fine with that. So that's one. But the second and the third things is, I think the second one is I write very well to deadlines and I'm very comfortable. Like book two, I just took 2 hours a day, 5 days a week. And so that helped me work through a full work day plus a full day at home plus, you know, getting the book done. And I shouldn't say this. I've been thinking a lot about writer's block and I've been reading journalists who write fiction, and they say they don't have writer's block because they never could afford to. And similarly, lawyers who write fiction, I've been listening to a few podcasts and they say the same thing. Maybe it's the same with academics. I don't, it could be famous last words, but I don't think I'm going to have writer's block because I can't afford to in my other job, right? You write all the time.
Knock on wood, right?
Knock on wood, absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, when you, but you, when you say you did 2 hours, you know, so you're 2 hours a day, 5 days a week and all that, that's kind of scheduled and or structured, and that kind of goes with deadline, yet you are not outlined. So it's kind of, that's kind of unusual. But when you have that 2 hours set, what if you're in a bad mood, or what if something's going on that you can't get your mind off of? Do you find that you can just turn it on and write then, or?
No. I play a lot of Sudoku. I start with Wordle. I move to Sudoku. I read, advice columns, which I'm a junkie for. And then I get up and make myself some tea, and then I come back. So it takes me off that 2 hours, I'd say the first 45 minutes, to kind of just ease into the writing. But there are times, so I know that if I have done like 2 bad days of not getting writing, the third day will get me in the mood. So I just show up and I'm there for the 2 hours, and eventually inspiration will strike. And that day, hopefully, if inspiration strikes, I can move my deadlines around and cancel a meeting or two and move it to 3 hours or 4 hours.
Yeah. You could always put a little bit of liquor in your tea.
Yes. Except unfortunately, no, these days, well, as I'm growing older, I find alcohol gives me migraines, which is sad, but that is what it is. So yes, it has to be plain tea.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, just trying to help here. when you write a book, like a crime book and stuff like that, who do you look for in an audience? Are you looking for a particular type of audience or a particular type of reader in mind?
To me, it's like maybe the kind of reader I was, someone who loves Agatha Christie, that kind of reader, or Golden Age mysteries, which to me are my favorites, you know. Neo Marsh, Agatha Christie, that whole period. Anyone who wrote in that period.
Yeah. And it's pretty, because the characters, you're right, the characters are important, and it's revealing and it's character driven. Mm-hmm. So it makes it a more interesting. So I notice you've got a jealous mother-in-law. So is this from personal experience?
No, I had the book. I actually had the sweetest mother-in-law, who's no longer here to read the book, but she would have loved it. But what I did want to show is so women of that time, right? And they were struggling to, especially independent women of that time, someone who wanted to be educated, wanted to make a life of her own. You really couldn't succeed unless you had some support. And so that's why she has, Kaveri has a very supportive husband, because in reality, unfortunately, it's still the case, right? It's very hard for a woman who's married to move ahead unless she has a supportive spouse. Not, unfortunately, men can move ahead with or without a supportive spouse, right? So I had to make sure that she had that for realism. But it didn't, on the other hand, if she didn't have any struggles, life wouldn't be interesting. So I gave her the jealous mother-in-law.
where do you get your characters from? Like, where do you get that kind of person, or in any of the other characters in there that are kind of supporting characters? Do you are they people you've run across, or do you take personalities from, I don't know, students? Any names you want to give us?
No, I'd say bits and pieces. You know, so for instance, there's a policeman there who was not part of the book at all. He turned up. So there was an incident where I was writing, and there was actually a younger policeman who was a constable who was writing down all the wrong things, and Kaveri was supposed to be getting annoyed with him, and her husband was getting annoyed with him, actually. And he was just boring. I still remember writing that, and he was stolid and boring and writing down with his pencil, and I realized I'm kind of feeling stolid and boring as I'm writing this. So the senior policeman, Ismail, came and took over. And I thought he would go away, but he didn't go away. So he's just there. And now he's a character who's, I think he's going to stay through a series of books. So, yeah, I don't think I make up characters very consciously. I think they just somehow come on board. I'm figuring out how.
Yeah, and so that's, it's an interesting process. Do you think that you've changed the way you write now that you've completed book one and going into book two? Is there a difference in how you're doing it now?
I mean, I had to do this in 4 months. So yes, I'd say I don't know how I did. So I was supposed to turn in the completed draft of book two by the end of December last year. And my mom is 85, lives with us and was very ill. And in October, November, was in the hospital in the ICU. And yes, famous last words, speaking of always being able to write and not having writer's block. The time she was very ill, she was very uncomfortable and I couldn't write. Just watching her in that discomfort switched my writing brain off. So I couldn't think and I couldn't write. But fortunately, by December, she was feeling much better and things had improved by January. So I actually wrote this. I wrote the outline in January and in 7 weeks, February at all through mid-March, I had the first version, very rough version of the second book done. And then I spent another 5 weeks revising it. And then I sent it off to them in April. And so that work, I have no idea how that worked. I think it was just sheer fright. I had this deadline looming and I had to get it done.
Yeah, it might be just the structure of the deadline, just of it that does it for you, right? It's like, I think it's a good thing. It's not a bad thing.
No, it's a good thing. Maybe it's also the fact that I also wasn't squeamish about having a murder woven in. Yeah. I think I got past that. So I think that to me was a big mental roadblock with draft one. And I mean, I don't know. So I'd like to write contemporary mysteries, murder mysteries again. And I find I'm stuck there much more because it seems somehow, you know, let's take the whole murder mystery as a format. It's lighthearted and it's supposed to be giving you entertainment. And at the same time, it's off the idea of a murder and it's off the idea of a death. And a death is something that destroys lives and destroys families. So I guess the way I've made my peace with it is this is historical and therefore I'm writing about times that were so far in the back that, you know, pain and everything has sort of grayed away and all you're trying to do is extract the life and the times of that period. But I really don't know what I'd do today.
Yeah, so when you were trying to overcome the murder part of it, was it just the scene or the actual murder and descriptions of it? Or was it the fact that there was a murder?
The fact that there was a murder. I have no problem describing the scene. It's the fact of, I guess it's a moral compunction. And
right.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. So how did you overcome it then? Like, what was the actual thing that got you over that hump of the moral thing? Like, how would you do that?
I don't know. I mean, I think, well, part of it, to be honest, I don't think about it that much. I push it aside. Part of the thing I think I have thought, if I look back at the Agatha Christie's that I really liked, for instance, or the other writer I love is the Patricia Wentworth, the Miss Silver series. It's always right. The bad people who get it, right?
Yeah.
So in a way, you know, justice is done at the end, even if it's not a really bad person, they're going away, made things better somehow. Because of other resolutions. So in the end, if justice is done and shown to be done, I guess that's the way I'm making peace with this.
Yeah, I think, you know, people put, you know, yeah, so the murderer in the book, without giving it away, where do you get that character from? Like, how do you draw that person? Or do you just sort of not really get detailed about them?
So I did not get detailed about them in the right. First book exactly, because that I found very hard to confront the fact that there was a murderer and why would someone do something like that is something that I found very uncomfortable. So, I mean, for instance, I was laughing about this because I was thinking of many writers who write true crime and recreate true crime. That is something I would definitely not do. Okay, that's just something I would find very difficult to do. But where did I get the character from? So I changed the murderer. So I had the draft, I had the character without giving it away. And the murderer I had in mind didn't quite fit because they didn't have a good motive for the murder. It seemed like a very contrived motive. So I changed the entire structure. So I had the events, but the murderer was different and therefore the motive for the murderer was different. And so I have to move things from the back of the book to the front of the book and from the front to the back and rearrange these chunks. And so, yeah, that's what I did for book one. For book two, I worked it out very differently. So I had the murderer very much in mind from the beginning, and I had a motive in mind for them. And then I worked out that 10-pager from that.
Yeah, it's an interesting process. Yeah, I couldn't imagine writing two crime. That's got to be awful. Awful person that does that. It'd be a terrible person that would do that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, so you're in India and you're writing in India. How is the crime fiction world in India? Like, how is it received over in India?
It's been received. I don't know. I mean, it's releasing tomorrow in India, so I'll have to see how it's actually received. But so many people seem to be excited about it, and there is a resurgence now of writers writing in that time period, right? So there's Sujata Massey's lovely Parveen Mistry book set in Bombay, which is about a young woman lawyer around the same period. There's Avin Mukherjee, who writes about Kolkata during that period, Calcutta. And there's a British detective who comes to India, and he has an Indian inspector who's working with him. And then there's Wasim Khan, who's writing about independent India. So it's 1950s, just after the British are out. And he's got the first woman inspector in Bombay solving mysteries. So there's a series of things in colonial, just post-colonial times, very interesting stuff. So I think there's all that coming together. But there's also been other stuff. I used to love H.R.F. Keating, the Inspector Ghote series. I don't know if you've ever seen that. And those are so realistic. And the fact that he'd never been to India before he wrote those books is just, to me, incredible. How you can get place and setting and atmosphere so right without visiting a country.
Yeah, that's a difficult process. Because, you know, you're not there and you don't know. There's so many subtle things. So that's a good thing to pull off. Do you write your setting? Is Bangalore itself written as a character?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Character?
Very much so. Because I think so much of my research is based in the ecology and the ecological history of Bangalore. So I feel like I know the city so intimately. Like, the lanes with the cowherds, the way they shape cow dung patties on the rocks, walking past the lakes and hearing, you know, watching a kite chasing a squirrel, or standing under a tamarind tree and being scared because a pishashi, who are these female ghost type creatures, would come and suck your soul. That is one of the myths here, that you stand under a tamarind tree and pishashis hang around the tamarind tree waiting to suck the spirits out of young, good-looking men, especially. So, you know, all of these are woven.
I don't have to worry about that there.
I better watch out.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Very much so. The city is absolutely a very strong character in my setting. I mean, in my books.
Now, on the first book, obviously it took a long time and there was all sorts of things going on. But in the part two that you've done, did you have an image, like a finished picture in your mind of what the story was going to, how it was going to end, what you were going to get from that story? Or again, did you write it the same way, even though it was such a short time?
So I wrote the 10-pager in the same way. I started with the opening scene. And I had no idea what I would get at the end of that 10-pager. So my first three, four pages, I'd say, was really the first chapter. Sketching that out, what would happen, you know, where she was, what she was looking at, how that happened. And then as it got to the second half of the book, I'd say the second half of the book was just in like maybe the last three pages. But I did have the basic arc of the plot from start to finish. And I knew who the bad guy was or the bad woman was. I'm not going to say which one. But I knew why broadly. And then there were details within that changed. But that's what, so I'd say that first outlining that I did in January, which is a fairly detailed outline, was something that I had no idea what I would end up with. I started and I just didn't know what I would get. And then the book itself, I broadly stuck to that.
Well, I'm wondering, you said your characters do kind of take over. Have they ever gone so far within these two books you've written to actually like rebel against the plot and go against kind of where you wanted the story to go?
No, I'd say not. But what I would do is, for me, it's really character driven. If they were going in a different direction, I'd bend the plot. Because if they were doing something that was inconsistent to the plot, to me, that means that the plot is all wrong. Not that the characters are rebelling. It just means that I haven't understood them well enough to take the plot along with them.
That makes sense.
So you kill them. what kind of research are you doing to make sure that the timing and that you know, because back in that time, people said things differently. They had different behaviors, you know, different life. It was completely different. Right. How much of the research did you have to do to get in there, and what kind do you do?
All kinds of things. Let's see. But obviously, the oral histories, like I was telling you, talking to people in my own family. But there are also some very nice biographies that people have produced of people in their own families, like their grandfather or their grandmother. And so I've been trying to source some of those because they have letters and photographs and stories of how they lived their times. Newspapers are really good because I found these little things, you know, for instance, there was a horse, pony and dog show and what happened in that horse, pony and dog show in this particular year. Or there was a train that was derailed because of some worker agitation, or there was a strike. So all these little details that come in, so you can make the story rich, but at the same time, you know what you're getting. You know, that's what makes it come alive. And then there was these debates, which some of them were fascinating. So it gives you a sense of mores of the time. So there was this entire debate on whether women should be allowed to vote in the legislative assembly. And one man says, you know, I have sisters and I have brothers, but my sisters are as intelligent as my brothers. And you're looking at this and saying, okay, so, but for his times, he was making a revolutionary statement. He's saying, if my sisters are as intelligent as my brothers, why is it that my brother can come to the legislative assembly, but you won't allow my sisters to? And then there's another man who responds saying, all the suffragette movement, etc., will work in the UK because in London, you have women who are highly educated and women who own property. And in India, you don't have either of the two. Are women queens, goddesses of their households. So they should stay at home and be goddesses of their households. They shouldn't come into the legislature. And it's going to be 100 years before women actually get voted into any positions. And this is 1921. And, you know, we're in, obviously, it didn't take 2021 for women to start getting the vote, right? But this gives you a sense of the mores of the time and how people debated and what they thought. So I can get some of those in and then put them into the story.
Yeah, that is it's a really interesting time. Do you, but with today's date, because you're writing in 2022 here, and mm-hmm. when you write to an audience of today's mind, there's a lot of political correctness. There's a lot of people that are worried right. about how things are said or why or what's offensive, what's not, which is fine. It's progress. But does that concern you when you're putting languages and behaviors of 100 years ago in there? Because, you know, of course, most of it would not be very, you know, very a very positive thing in the millennials' eyes. So do you have to kind of work that in a certain way, do you find, or do you even worry about it?
I do. So I had to, actually. I did not worry about it. And then, for instance, my editor pointed this out. So one of the characters who had a much more sympathetic tone in my first version of the book that my editor took was a character who was drunk and used to beat his wife. And what they said was, so if you look back at times of in those times, there were men who got drunk almost, I mean, every man or many men, let's say, would get drunk and beat their wives, but they would also provide for their wives and care for their children while getting drunk and beating them. You know, so that complexity or that richness is something that is very hard to bring out, I think, in today's books, because it would be, okay, here's this man who's beating his wife. He's obviously obnoxious. He cannot be a sympathetic character. So I had to actually change that portrayal of his to fit how people would be reading him also in a very different context, because I'm writing in India, but I'm being read by people in the UK, people in the US, people whom, and what the editors were also pointing out, which is true, is that this itself has changed, because even 20 years ago, people were writing characters like this into books, but you can't today. And that is progress. I agree with you. It's nice because you understand that, you know, however complex the character is, guy shouldn't be allowed to get away with beating his wife brutally every evening and saying, I'm a good guy because I otherwise provide for her, right? So I had to think about that and change the treatment I did of that particular character. And I have to say that in book two, I kept those considerations in mind when I was talking about other kinds of complex characters. And so, which does mean I've had to simplify some things, or not, I don't want to say simplify, I'll say essentialize some characters, right? So talk about one part of them and make that good or bad, which I would not necessarily have done in another way. But yeah, I do see the point.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just one of those things you have to be aware of, I think, now, because mm-hmm. people have that on their minds. Right. So that they're thinking in the terms, that in a way, you could almost say they're looking for that kind of an issue, right? So, right. You know, it's like, do you have a particular thing you want a reader to get out of this book besides the entertainment part of the story, like the murder and the, mm-hmm. and the fun stuff in the book? Is there like an underlying theme or subtext to this?
I would say strong women, strong feminism. I mean, the fact that a determined, strong woman could do so much even in times when the odds were stacked against her. But on the other hand, I also want them to, I mean, it's not that simple, because there were a lot of determined, strong women who didn't have the agency. Right? So I guess I want them to take away that women have substantive and very surprising strength in the most adverse of times. But on the other hand, the system was stacked away against them. And there was so much they had to do to get ahead. But it's in the foot, it's because they carved those paths that many of us are able to follow today.
Yeah, it's interesting. Did you have any problem trying to get the correct slang and sort of talk of the time, you know, like rather than make it sound like they're in 2020, to make it sound more like 1920, like the different, you know, how people have different mm-hmm. slang, or they have short mm-hmm. sayings or things that they say rather than speaking full sentences. Was that an issue to try and get that?
Not really, you know, because India, I mean, some parts of India really changed dramatically, I'd say only from the 1990s or thereabouts. So the India that I grew up in and went to school and college in, I went to a convent school, and the kind of slang we used and the words we used, I see them in the newspapers of the 1920s. It hadn't changed that much between the 1920s and the 1970s. It's later that a lot of these changes came in. And again, just, you know, all I have to do is close my eyes and think of my grandmother or my aunt and the little sayings or the little, you know, the way they spoke, what they highlighted, the little moral values they tried to inculcate, or, you know, just little things like that. And a lot of that just comes back. And I can feed that into the book. There was, so India, large parts of India had not changed substantially. It's only in the past 20 or 30 years that this huge change in the kind of slang people use or the kinds of ways they talk, it's a lot more American now. It used to be a lot more British before. Right? So some things jump out at me. I mean, I would never, for instance, write. I was listening to someone who had written a book set in the Agatha Christie times in the UK, but is American. And she was saying she had to give it to someone else who pointed out that you wouldn't say sidewalk, but you'd say pavement. You wouldn't say line, but you'd say queue. But these are things I myself, when I first went to the US, had to change a lot of the words I was using. I was using the wrong words. You know? I'd go ask someone in the grocery store for my film, but film here means raw film, but film for us means developed film after you take the photographs. You know, so these things were sort of automatic, I'd say.
Well, you know, you mentioned earlier, too, that you had to pull some stuff from the back of the book and put it into the front and kind of... you know, make some changes. And do you have any, like, a process or tools or anything to track your changes and to keep track of everything so that the story runs smoothly?
I'm very low tech. I use Word and I have Excel. So I have chapters written in Excel, and sometimes occasionally I'll pull scenes out of that, or I take a notebook and I sketch. Nothing fancy. Yeah. Just Word and Excel.
That works.
It works. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you know, is each book in the series going to stand on its own, or do you have to start from the beginning?
They, you know, each book will stand on its own. So I would love for people to just jump in and dive straight into book two or book three. And then if they like that, then to go back to books one and two.
Yeah. It's important that way. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the inspiration, what's your inspiration when you write? Do you listen to music? Do you, you know, watch movies? Is there go for a walk? And is there something that kind of gets you writing?
So I have in my bedroom a really old couch. The springs are gone, and it's been COVID times. We haven't been able to get anyone in to get it reupholstered. So it's threadbare. But I sit, so especially the times that I cannot write, I have to sit with my laptop in the worst, most, you know, unergonomic position, cross-legged on that couch with my laptop scrunched over it, and write, and with some music on, and play Sudoku when that doesn't work. And eventually it works, and it does.
That's funny. So how do you like this now, the new world, you know, and the social media and stuff? Do you have a lot of accounts? Do you do, like, Instagram or anything? How do people get in touch with you?
The one thing that is new is I now have a personal website, which is just my name, www.harininagendra.com. But I've always, so it's been a while, I've had Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and LinkedIn, because I use them for my nonfiction, both my academic work and the nonfiction books. And so it's really all over the page. If you get to my Twitter or Instagram account, you'll read about climate change, you'll read about old Bangalore, you'll read about civic issues, you might get a nice photograph of a lovely tree or a lake or a flower, and then you'll get a little bit about detective fiction. So it is, you know, a bit eclectic and all over the place. But I've done that for a while. So yeah, social media is something I don't have a massive following, but I have a reasonable following, and it's something I like doing, because I've got to know so many different people from different parts of the world. So that's been fun. But what I find very interesting is different people take, so clearly I thought it would be the same thing. I put the same material on all four, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. And I get completely different audiences who say completely different things. So the same post can get really picked up on Facebook and nobody, you know, looks at it twice on any other social media platform.
Well, you know, you mentioned Agatha Christie, and I was just wondering, what about her work has influenced your writing?
I think it's very atmospheric and it's very character-driven. And so that part I love. I mean, really, if you look back at some of those plots, they're really contrived. Something that she's figuring out and how they did the murders, in 5 minutes, if someone miscalculated or the wrong person entered at the wrong time, everything would have fallen apart. So I think the plots are very complex, but maybe people like that at that time. They wouldn't really hold up, I think, to modern scrutiny. But the characters still live with you so much.
Timeless.
And I love this idea of the noticing woman, you know, the woman who sat at home and noticed everything. So Kaveri, my heroine, has Uma auntie, who's the gossipy elderly woman neighbor who's behind her house. And she knows everything and she knows everyone. And that complementarity to me is very interesting because it's the husband who has his formal workplace. So he knows how the official machinery works. He can go to the police station. He can get the evidence. He knows who has what jobs. But Kaveri, because of Uma auntie and the other connections, can get into women's kitchens and homes and know who's talking to whom, who fights with whom, who has how many kids, is someone having an affair, you know, all of the other things.
All the good stuff.
Yeah.
All the good stuff. Yes. All
the good stuff. So where do you see yourself going with this? Are you going to do how many books in the series, or are you going to do other series? Like, where do you, now that you've got this new crime fiction career, what's going to happen?
So the Little Brown has taken 3 books, which I'm very glad about. So I have this one, the second one that I've turned in, and book 3 to write next year. And I'd love for them to take more. I mean, who knows, right? So it all depends on how people like, whether people like the book, whether I'm doing a good job. We'll have to see. But I can definitely see myself writing a whole bunch of series because there's so much I want Kaveri to explore. There's, you know, so the Survey of India, which is I make maps in my parallel academic life. And there's so much with the Survey of India expeditions at this time of jewels and secret places to explore. So I'd love to work some of those map making things into this. You know, what if someone went and got a secret jewel from somewhere and that somehow gets involved in a murder? And there's Jadu, there's this whole work of, so there were Indian sorcerers and magicians, and then there was Western magic beginning to influence them with Houdini, etc. And so there's this whole confluence of Jadu, which is the Indian magic, and then the British magicians and the American magicians. So I'd love to write about that. There's so much that I could put into series. So I'd love to do a long series with this if someone would have it. And I'd love to set something in contemporary Bangalore too, because I feel like Bangalore today is such a city of contrast. You have the IT sector and these large skyscrapers, and then you have the slums and the poverty, and then you have the rich exploration of culture, which is the new fusion culture, and then you have the old culture of the heart of the city. And so, yeah, I'd love to do a contemporary series at some point. But then I also have this day job and a child and a parent to look after and a husband who occasionally likes to spend time with me. So we'll see.
Well, yeah, yeah. Life happens. You got to keep up with
life
it,
happens.
You know,
exactly.
Otherwise, yeah, you know, it's kind of strange, you know, in that way.
Yes.
Well, it's really interesting. You know, I hear quite a few authors I've talked to over time think or say that they see there's a difference between UK English mystery detectives and, let's say, American detectives in the writing, especially of old times that we're talking in the 1900s, 1920s and stuff. Do you find the same, and which do you kind of swing toward?
I do find the same, and I like reading both kinds, but I would swing towards the British kind when I write, for sure.
Why do you think that is? Like, what is it that attracts you about the English sort of mystery detectives?
I guess they're less gritty. The Dashiell Hammett type of, you know, Raymond Chandler, those kinds of detectives. First of all, there were fewer amateur detectives, I think, in the American tradition, and they were much more, they saw the serious parts of life. They were out in the streets. There was always a beautiful mall and and this guy with a fedora hat or, you know, chewing tobacco. And the British ones are more genteel, very grim too, because there's a whole lot of dark stuff that goes on in those churches and in those genteel houses, right? So there's every kind of horrific activity that you can think of going on there. But there's a certain, I like the contrast, I guess, about the genteelness of the facade, you know, the lovely furnishings and the lovely buildings and the clothes and jewels. So you can write a lot of this atmospheric stuff in there, but then human nature is still the same.
Yeah. Yeah. The crime and the violence, sex, that's all sort of, it translates everywhere, but it's just kind of a way of presenting it, I guess.
Right.
You know, it seems to be a different way. I noticed that too. You know, how do you think the Indian audience will be, more British or more American for their mystery?
I suspect more British, because that is the kind of mysteries that we all grew up reading. A lot of Agatha Christie, a lot of the old British writers, Dorothy Sayers, that kind of writing.
How did you deal with COVID and all of that? And did it affect your writing?
It did. So not the first lockdown, I'd say, but the second lockdown was, once the Delta waves hit, first of all, I think there was so much death in India. I mean, so many people that, our own students, for instance, and it was pretty horrific because, last thing you want to do is see the very young pass away. And so it was a hard time. And India had the longest school closure. So my daughter had close to 2 years of online school. I think the first year was fine, but the second year was very frustrating for all the children and therefore for their parents, right? I think between those things being locked down, we were fortunate not to have had COVID in those waves, again, knock on wood. But the trauma of all of that, and my mom in hospital, the university opening and closing, and all the students, I think it was very traumatic for all our students. So just watching all of that, I think, was a very hard time.
Yeah,
and that affected my writing. It really made it was very difficult to think and focus, or to let's put it this way, to take the time to do something as self-indulgent as writing something fun just seemed wrong at that time. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, and plus, you know, the stress and the anxiety has got to be.
Yeah.
You know, it makes it much harder to write. You know, especially something like you said, fun and stuff like that. Yeah. When you do your books, so you say fun and humor and stuff like that, are you particular about the type of humor or how much humor you could put in or even the right timing of that humor?
No, I'm trying to learn more. I would actually like them to be more humorous. So what I do is by accident. And so I realized this because my editor said, you know, she marked a couple of scenes and she said, this is really nice. And can you make these parts more funny? I have no idea how to do that. It either happens or it doesn't. So, yeah.
I'll just call Dave. He knows.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He's the humor. Good humor, man. Yeah. So what do you think would be, you know, here's one. What do you think that Americans get wrong about India? What is it that you think we should know about India that we don't?
Ooh, good one. I mean, I don't know. These days, I think everyone visits everywhere. So I can't think of anything specific that anyone would get wrong. I have to say, when I first started visiting the US, I did meet some people, not a lot, but some people who still thought it was a land of, you know, cows on the road, peacocks everywhere, snake charmers, and that kind of stuff. But that was still a very small fraction of people. So,
You mean the cows aren't on the road?
They are, actually. There's still quite a lot of cows on the road in Bangalore.
Yeah.
But maybe not the snake charmers.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Yeah. Snake charmers have moved to the U.S., so they have a new location and a new job. Well, it's certainly been a great conversation with you. And, of course, we're going to have your website up on ours, and we'll have your book and everything so people can do one click and find you and find out more about you and stuff like that. So great conversation, and I hope we get to do it again. You know,
I love that. I had so much fun.
Now, of course, the book we're talking about is The Bangalore Detectives Club, and it's the first book in the series. We've got book 2 coming out soon, too. You know, she's already got it done. She's on it. she's really going to get this going. So everyone, you know, get out. This is a book you need to buy. It's going to give you a lot of good information, a lot of good fun. Well, maybe not a lot of fun, but it's going to be, it's a murderer, right? But so our guest is the writer, Harini Najenda. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Harini.
Thanks.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.